gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to the year 2020 and the podcast Fighting in the War Room, sort of.
We're almost
I'm
back.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. Yeah. I'm Dave Gonzalez. I'm here with Matt Patchetts. We are the two members who have entered the War Room in the new year.
I guess Katie and David have
quit. Together. They'll come back around.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't want to start any rumors.
You stepped on the ninth year announcement. This is going to be year nine. Year nine of podcasting together about stuff.
That's crazy. That's wild,
yeah.
I should say. What was our first movie was Rabbit? What's it called? What's the Nicole Kidman movie based on award-winning play?
I think canonically the first one is David and Katie talking about 127 Hours, which would put it... when we were Operation Kino, and we put it in November of 2010. So here we are, rolling through year nine into the end of this year.
Nothing's changed.
Fighting in the War Room X.
Everything's exactly as it was 9 years ago.
Uh-huh. Everything's the same.
What's the biggest thing that has happened to you in the last 9 years?
The biggest thing that has happened to me in the last 9 years?
Yeah.
I moved, I guess. I don't know.
How long ago did you move? 5 years ago?
Five years ago? Yeah.
Do you miss it at all? I guess we kind of talked about this in our New York quarter quail, but maybe we didn't, and you should.
I mean, I didn't really miss it until it's occasionally things that pop culture. Like, I recently read a book called Meet Me in the Bathroom. It's an oral history about rock in New York City, rock music from 2000 to 2010. And that, you know, hit me in the nostalgia feels. Because I was like, hey, I went to that shitty club.
Which club?
That sort of thing. Oh, Lit. They talk about Lit a lot.
What was that,
Lit
Lower East Side?
Yeah, down the Lower East Side.
Oh, man. I was just driving through the Lower East Side, looking at places where, or at least corners, where I would probably be standing in the freezing cold at like 3 a.m. trying to hail a cab, which is now an archaic notion because I would have Ubered from inside the club or whatever and gone home. But you know what?
Yeah,
I miss that. I miss that sense memory. I have those sense memories of being really cold and really anxious to go home and really need to pee probably. I don't miss that. And that wasn't this decade, but.
I have lots of wandering home and trying to make it okay that I was wandering home by being like, I'm really into this podcast, or I'm going to listen to this album, or I'm going to chain smoke a lot of cigarettes. But really, I was walking home long distances in the rain.
What was the longest walk you ever took in New York, do you recall?
The longest walk?
Because you can do that. You can accidentally do that in New York a lot. Like, I used to live on the Upper East Side, and we'd go out on the Lower East Side, and I'd walk all the way home during the summer.
Yeah. Yeah. I did some toy and bee tile walks where I would walk in between all the toy and bee tiles, and that's pretty long. But I think the longest one I ever did is, or maybe it's the longest and the latest, was I was covering this band for an online publication, and they were playing in like a club off Times Square. And I went and I saw the show, and I talked to the band in like the green room, and they offered me like some cocaine, and I like took it. And I was like, I'm just going to walk home. And I dictated the entire story into my phone as I was walking home from Times Square to the Lower East Side. And it was weird. And it was even weirder the next morning, like typing all that out.
What did cocaine do to your brain? It doesn't have the same effect on everyone.
What did cocaine do to my brain? I don't know. Sped me up and...
I guess that's what it's supposed to do.
Made me feel like I was having like real deep connections with people when I wasn't.
Let me ask you this.
Which I think is like one of the better side effects of it.
Do you think Saturday Night Live is less funny because people are not on as much cocaine? Or wait, here's a better question. Do you think Star Wars isn't as good because the cast members aren't doing cocaine between takes and spending just massive amounts of downtime with each other doing cocaine? I really think there's something to this. That the original trilogy is great because they're really close-knit, because they were doing massive amounts of drugs. And now you have this kind of sterile environment where the cast members are clearly not friends and they don't really want to hang out with each other. And you can tell.
Well, I mean, I don't know how much we want to mix cocaine into that. But yeah, one of the side effects of cocaine is that you feel like you're really connecting with people, but you aren't. So I definitely agree with your thesis about like having a close-knit group. I don't think it's necessarily beneficial to have a close-knit group of people all doing drugs together making a film. That sounds like more like Suicide Squad and less like Star Wars.
See, I disagree. I disagree because a lot of these 70s movies where they're in the trenches and they're like, we're just shooting, you know, like Altman films, they're always talking about how everyone was living together and doing cocaine and then they'd go off and shoot improv. And I even think Star Wars is like this, where they were hanging out so much. We see all these photographs of like Carrie Fisher and Harrison Ford and Mark Hamill kind of being buddy-buddy. And well, especially Harrison Ford thinking it was all really stupid. But probably doing enough cocaine and being able to pay for enough cocaine that it didn't matter. And now I don't know. I do think the sterile environments that we created, which are healthier for people, it's demonstrably better for people's lives that we don't have as much cocaine. But it's not as in the weeds. It's not as like close knit. I do think there's something we lose by taking drugs out of the equation of mainstream Hollywood. And SNL is another example. Like SNL is, hey, we're gonna have 4 a.m. nights where we're coming up the weirdest stuff because we're in a very bad place. And now everyone will tell you it's not really like that anymore. And yeah, we know.
I'm going to read your wishes. I wish creative people could do more cocaine, in which case I'm all for it, I guess. Drugs affect different people different ways, and movies are productions. And although the part of Hollywood that you're talking about, it has been very romanticized and did produce some good art. Like there are stories in like Easy Rider, Raging Bull, the book, where they're like exchanging script pages with like George Lucas
with
and Martin
devil.
Scorsese and Fratton Ford Coppola. Yeah, and the
they're
devil.
Literally seeing
they're
him.
All like bouncing ideas off each other, which is all great, but they're all people that, you know, ran potentially abusive set environments.
Yes, no, there's I don't want to romanticize it too much. But I do think that a lot of these negative things that I'm glad that we've cut out of people's lives or we've convinced people not to indulge in also actually help the artistic process.
I've moved on to an oral history of Saturday Night Live, so I'll get
you
back
have.
To you on
which
the...
Which one?
Wait, yeah, the Live from New York?
Oh, I mean, that is a fantastic book. Is this a new version that's come out recently that has additional quotes from some of the newer cast members?
This is the newest possible version. I think it was right after the 40th anniversary. I'm just going back through the entertainment oral histories.
Boy, oh boy.
Trying to brush up on my stuff. But your thing about Saturday Night Live and cocaine might be onto something, because there is an alchemy to a group of people that are trying to make each other laugh on a schedule and how they deal with that, whether it be cocaine or just like over caffeinated silliness or like weird depression that can only be let out by sketch comedy. I think that alchemy is occasionally missing from a Saturday Night Live that has pivoted to be, I don't know, whatever it is now.
Let me segue from celebrities in Hollywood doing drugs to the topic we've decided to talk about today, which is the Golden Globes, which aired a few days ago when you're listening to this, audience. But because we don't have Katie here, we don't have David here, and all of them will get their moment in award sun, I'm sure. You and I are going to talk about the Golden Globes. I've taken some important notes to start our conversation. And I want to lead you down the winding path of the Golden Globes, which don't matter at all. And yet, do they? This year, the Oscars is actually much closer to, or at least the Oscar nomination date. By the time people listen to this, I think the Oscar voting is almost closed, which is rare. Usually, you have 2 or 3 weeks between the Golden Globe Awards that can influence people and that when people actually vote for the Oscars. So this year, the window is closer. I don't know if that matters. I mean, the Oscars don't matter. Nothing really matters. In this case, the Golden Globes may influence the Oscars more. So we are going to talk about them. And here's my first question for you, Dave. On top of all the movie stuff, which we'll get to, the Golden Globes also include some TV categories. Fleabag won, Succession won, Chernobyl won, Michelle Williams won for Fosse Verdon and gave a very impassioned speech about women's choice. That was startling. It was a forceful speech. It was a good speech. My question to you is, how much time do you think you've wasted watching TV in the last decade?
Ooh, how much time have I wasted watching TV?
There's just so much television. And I'm wondering if you feel like reflecting on all this TV that maybe some of it wasn't. What do you think you've spent the most time watching that ultimately has no cultural footprint or it did not stick at all for you? Do you feel like you've spent a lot of time watching TV even in the last decade? I don't know.
Yeah, I think I spent a lot of time watching TV in the last decade. So I used to have this thing with my friend Emily in New York where every Monday we would get together and we'd watch like 3 hours of TV and we would eat and then we would talk about TV and we would always choose different shows either to watch or rewatch. Sometimes they were airing and we'd, you know, like DVR them and watch them on Mondays. I think it started on Mondays because it was 24, back towards the end of 24.
We were all watching 24. Everyone, like... 24 was so big. 24 is the weirdest show that's ever happened in retrospect, because I feel like everyone of a certain age was watching it somewhat religiously. When I got to college, so that would have been like 2004, my girlfriend at the time and I were like watching 24 every night, watching Kiefer Sutherland like break lamps and electrocute people's nipples to get answers. What a heinous show. What an awful act. Like, why didn't I think that this was a problem? Was I so dizzy and drunk in Bush's America that I just didn't think twice about torture? And why wasn't this a problem? I was angry about politics, but I wasn't angry about 24. Jack Bauer was awesome.
Yes. 24 sneaks up on you and gets more conservative as it goes along, like really hitting the gas in season two. Post 9/11, because the first season was shot before that, and therefore is a suspense show that is about keeping real time and preventing the assassination of a black presidential candidate. And doesn't it really have anything to do with drone warfare or straight up hating Middle Easterners or using torture to get things out of people? Jack Bauer is pretty torture light until the event at the end of season one that kind of closes his heart off to everybody except people who could be tortured later on. The thing that really balanced out 24 for me was Battlestar Galactica was going on at the same time and was doing like the reverse of 24, where the characters we like were suddenly being interned on New Caprica and whatnot, and they switched that metaphor. I mean, the whole show was about 9/11, but at some point, the Battlestar Galactica switched to be much more forward about looking at both sides and the pointlessness of the overall conflict.
You're saying that
24 just was like the president was in on it.
There were quite a few moles on 24. Wait, you're saying Battlestar Galactica was about 9/11, the reboot?
Yes.
How?
Yes.
I watched maybe the first half of the first season of Battlestar Galactica. They're running out of water, right?
They're like attacked. They're attacked by a devil of their own making in a way they never thought possible, and suddenly humanity seems a lot smaller, and they all have to learn how to get along, and they try to find God, and instead they turn out that God's dead, and they're in an endless time loop, Battlestar Galactica.
They're in a time loop?
Also 9/11. Not a time loop necessarily. You know how Battlestar Galactica ends, don't you?
No. I actually somehow have remained spoiler-free. I don't know how the whole series ends. I know it has, like, a twisty ending. Maybe I shouldn't.
The last shot is definitely modern-day Times Square. That's what I'll say about that.
And you think this is 9/11. What is the most direct metaphor or blunt metaphor in Battlestar Galactica?
On the packet about what sort of series it was going to be, Ron Moore sent along with the pilot script, he said this is a series about 9/11.
That'll do it. That seems my deep read of that is that it's about 9/11.
Yeah.
So much.
Anyway, I'm sorry to derail you with that, but I watch a lot of TV.
Absolutely not. This is part of my, this is the extended answer that I was looking for.
But the weird thing this year is Fleabag is like what I watched of the things that won awards. I was out of Succession. I watched one episode of Chernobyl, but was like living in a fucking Game of Thrones fugue state, and I forget why I didn't continue Chernobyl, but just never got around to it. And I'm not a Crown person, so I felt like I watched a lot of TV this year and a lot of TV that I enjoyed. But Fleabag is the only one that I could. Well, I mean, Fleabag was among the best TV of the year for sure, but I apparently didn't watch some of the really good TV.
There's just so much TV. I mean, I guess the good news is, I mean, I was poking you to tell me what TV show you thought you wasted your time with, and it's probably increasingly difficult to waste your time with television now because you can buy into whatever you want. There's a zillion options.
I watched every episode of Pan Am.
Okay, that was a waste of time. Why did you do that? Wait, was Pan Am Margot Robbie? Or was Pan Am Christina Ricci?
Christina Ricci.
There were two competing shows at that time.
That's right.
And it was just, what is the Margot Robbie one? That's going to plague me. Look this up while I tell a story. Margot Robbie, I was just thinking about her because she was at the Golden Globes. Here, let me loop back all the way to our main topic. She's obviously having a career high. She was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. She's nominated for Bombshell, which she's pretty good in.
Margot Robbie was also on Pan Am. We're just talking
shit
about Pan Am.
Yes, okay. She was on Pan Am. So Pan Am shot in New York City, and this was one of her first roles. She's Australian, and I had no idea who she was, and I once played Flip Cup with Margot Robbie at a Brooklyn party. That's my big New York story. Maybe I've said this on the podcast because I love to drop names and sound really important, but yes, Margot Robbie shot in New York, so she was, of course, at a backyard Brooklyn party for some reason, and we played Flip Cup, and it was like, hey, this girl's on Pan Am, and I'm like, never seen it, probably won't watch it, will never be famous. And then now she's Harley Quinn.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, notable for other things, hopefully, when her career, long and illustrious career is over. It's going to be, like, growing up and watching, like, the Oscars or the Golden Globes from, like, you know, the floor in front of your TV stand, and it's a 4:3 television. It's like Anthony Hopkins coming up for, like, Silence of the Lambs, and it's like, you know, people overlooking Star Trek to talk about NYPD Blue, but it's like these huge figures that seemed large because I only knew them from their media personas, and it makes me feel sad that a whole bunch of people are going to be like, oh yeah, Joaquin Phoenix, the Joker, Harley Quinn, that's Margot Robbie. Like, Ben Affleck played Batman.
It makes you sad that the celebrities are filtered through IP characters, or like.
Yeah, or like once you touch an IP character, it like stains you, even if you don't do like a great job this time. I don't know. Joker's fine.
I want to dig deeper into this thought. One, do you see Cate Blanchett and think Hela from Thor Ragnarok? Is that, you mean people will carry that with her? Is that what you're suggesting? That, like, no matter how famous she is, she's part of the MCU, and that's how most people will know her?
I think to, like, a certain generation, like, if you're an IP person, like, would I know, like, the star? Oh, I mean, I'd probably know, like, you know, some of the stars from, like, the Adam West's Batman. But, like, would I know who Frank Gorshin was if he didn't play the Riddler? Probably not.
Frank Ocean? Is that what you said?
Gorshin? Yeah, Frank Ocean. Would I know who Frank Ocean was if I didn't watch Batman?
Yes.
Or, like,
you would.
Fair. There's just certain people who I think do good work in superhero properties, but because superhero properties aren't nerd-ass shit anymore, they're getting folded into people's nostalgia. Right. So, like, instead of having movie stars now, you have whoever played Batman when you were a kid. It's going to be someone you pay attention to, which luckily for me was, like, Michael Keaton and Val Kilmer and not Ben Affleck. Well, I guess it doesn't sound so lucky when I say it out loud.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was reading during the Golden Globes because Joaquin won for Joker, and then obviously this is the second time someone has won a Golden Globe for playing the Joker. Heath Ledger won posthumously. But this is actually the third time that somebody has been nominated for playing the Joker. Jack Nicholson was nominated for a Golden Globe for playing Joker in the 1989 Batman. Now, do you think Jack Nicholson carries the stain of Joker? Why did Jack Nicholson transcend being the Joker when other people could not? Because it's he wasn't, I mean, to answer my own question, I guess he wasn't a chameleon in that way. He wasn't immersing himself into the Joker. The Joker was just Jack Nicholson for a while.
Yeah, and I think to a lot of people who are younger than us, he is the Joker, which is probably really weird.
Younger than us? I hope older than us, because if they're younger than us and they think Jack Nicholson's the Joker, that seems weird.
I mean, that would be the Jack Nicholson performance they probably see first. What Jack Nicholson performance do you show your children?
Well, do you think that...
Like, Chinatown's canceled, so that's out.
Chinatown. Chinatown is not canceled. That's going to be the most controversial thing I say in 2020. I really started the decade off with it.
Here's the thing. Chinatown's canceled. We're just looking for the canonical replacement for it in film studies classes, but it's not essential. It's not essential enough that it needs to be uncanceled.
Wait, now hold on. Do you find that a canceled...
I love Chinatown.
Okay, love Chinatown. The movie is canceled because Roman Polanski, there's no denying... That shit is wrong. Like, that is toxic.
And then
shit.
Also, it has with stayed. The particular storyline of Chinatown.
Okay, yes, that's fucked. But in a vacuum, it's operating as a great film. You don't need to show it. It's not a great film because it gets shown in film studies classes. It's not, like, it's... Does it have to be canceled? That's what I don't understand. What does canceled mean in 2020?
It's a great film. If you watched it and you liked it like I did, you're not like evil inherently. But if we're not looking for a canon replacement solution to teach the same cinema lessons Chinatown does, then I think we're being lazy. So I'm sure there's another.
So you need to have a replacement ready.
Hard-boiled.
You can't cancel a movie without having the replacement ready. You can't just have a movie.
I feel like that puts. That I mean, I could express the opinion for sure. I can't break into your house and destroy your copy of Chinatown until I have a replacement ready, but I could make the suggestion.
Let's work this out. Why is Chinatown a great film in your estimation? By the way, Netflix is making another Chinatown or like making a show. Robert Towne is writing. He's going to replace Chinatown with new Chinatown.
Which is great.
I've been thinking a lot about this. So Alien Ant Farm really did us a favor.
The new Smooth Criminal.
I was listening to Smooth Criminal by Alien Ant Farm in the car. It's exactly almost the same, except it's pop rock bullshit. It's definitely karaoke ready. People are like, should we keep Michael Jackson music? Should we not? No, we shouldn't keep Michael Jackson movie. That stuff is even more tainted than something like Chinatown to me. But why can't we get people just record every single Michael Jackson track so we can continue to listen to the songs, but they can be done by, I mean, it would still give money to, I guess, him in the afterlife.
Well, but you could like phase it out for sure. You could pull a Johnny Cash Hurt on it and just suddenly it's somebody else's song. I think there are people that could make
transformative covers.
So we need some rescued, I think, more than others. I think someone should rescue PYT because it's a great song, but I cannot listen to it without starting to think about what the song is and what it's saying and then what it could have really been saying, and it's weird. But then, do we have to get rid of the Jackson 5 stuff? That's pre-taint, I feel. I just feel sad.
Please don't use the phrase pre-taint when we're talking about Michael Jackson. But I agree with you. Jackson 5 is in.
Pre-tainted a couple ways.
Jackson 5 is in. Michael Jackson is very much out. But I do think that we should collectively agree to record covers by famous people who can still make them slap in the same way and then reintegrate them back into the airwaves. Because I can't believe I'm still like turning on the radio and hearing Michael Jackson songs. This next decade, we better get over that shit. But it's radical to think that Robert Towne is stepping in for Netflix, and I think he's going to redo Chinatown. It's kind of what the world needs. It's exactly right.
Yeah, yeah.
Just do the same thing. You did it right the first time. It's going to be great. Fincher, sure. Maybe you'll make it. And then it's like, more Chinatown.
Yeah, I know.
Just
get someone who can already competently shoot thrillers and just get them to competently shoot a well-written Chinatown. And that's mostly what it is. It's a really well shot noir thriller that has like some of the key things, the way that Murder on the Orient Express has like some of the key things of Agatha Christie. Chinatown encapsulates some of the key things of like the Raymond Chandler noir era and that sort of detective. Take that, but then do it in a way that is not by a gross filmmaker.
Just watch The Night of the Hunter. They're not alike at all, but that's noir.
I mean, that's not, I think that's perfectly reasonable. I think if you watch like Night of the Hunter and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, you're basically where I want you to be from watching Chinatown anyway, just with two wildly different genres.
There you go. Okay, let me get back to the Golden Globes by asking this question. Best animated film went to Missing Link, the film by Laika, stop motion animated, mostly reviled. Like, it does, people did not like Missing Link. I should admit I haven't seen the film. I know that David, not to besmirch him by saying that he's going against the grain here, but he likes the film a lot. I saw him on Twitter saying that it's the worst of Laika is the best. It's still great animation, so people should probably check Missing Link out and make their own assertion. Did you see Missing Link?
I did not see Missing Link. It's not, it literally, if it came to theaters, I just was unaware that that time period was the time to see Missing
Link. It came for like 3 weeks. It bombed. But here's the thing. Do you believe in Bigfoot?
I'm going to say, sure, I'll let some magical realism into my life.
You seem not, you don't seem confident that you do. Why would you
I'm wondering,
not?
I'm wondering why what I'm endorse. Why would I not? I'm worried about endorsing it because I've seen some, you know, like Bigfoot searching documentaries and they're ridiculous, like ghost hunters and they're charlatans and snake oil people, or just dumb people. But like the Flat Earth documentary, it makes me, being aggressively dumb in a public forum sometimes makes me mad. But can I say that, you know, this old-time X-Files fan wants to completely throw out the idea of a ape species living somewhere we haven't explored yet? No. So I'm going to go with yes.
What is the most X-Files-y thing that you actually believe in? I don't think you really believe in the Bigfoot. I think you've opened your heart to Bigfoot being real, as opposed to truly believing in Bigfoot.
Sure,
I don't think
sure.
I believe in Bigfoot. A lot of the I was weaned on all of the 90s, but besides X-Files, you know, like Unsolved Mysteries and anything that would involve those bad Bigfoot photos that are his silhouette walking through the. Why can't you get it? You would absolutely get a real picture of Bigfoot if he was real. End of story. If we can go to the deepest point on Earth to capture fish that glow in the dark, you would be able to find Bigfoot. Nothing on land could not be captured by a camera at this point. Yes or no?
Yeah, presumably.
Unless you're like a bird that goes too high.
Well, I mean, like, in theory, there could be, like, two big feet, and, like, it's just, like, that thing.
I don't, radical.
That's the magical realism that's hard to get rid of, is, like, I acknowledge that we know 99% of, like, the questions that I had after watching The X-Files. Like, a lot of those have been either exposed through, like, history or better technology, or, like, just my understanding. Just, like... The cognitive dissonance it comes with that we were given camera phones and what we really discovered was the police would beat people, not that they were aliens. Like, that sort of thing is what runs through my mind. Like, you're right. If it exists, we should be able to have a picture of it. But it's like all the shit that we did dig up, I'm as gobsmacked by that. So, like...
This got real.
Is believing in Bigfoot any weirder by the fact that now I believe in institutionalized racism more than I did when I watched The X-Files? I don't know.
Wow. Yeah. You're blowing my mind here. I mean.
You think Katie and David are going to listen to this podcast?
I hope they do. This is a good podcast. But wait, you didn't answer my question. What's the most X-Filesy thing that you actually believe in? Because in the last 5 years, there's been video that's run on New York Times of UFOs.
Yes, I absolutely believe there is a small group of white people that control certain things that are super vitally important, like an extra government like weird syndicate group. I'm not
that's
saying,
officially part of the government, like a part of the government authorized by the government.
Maybe was once part of the government. Okay, so even as a liberal minded person, imagine 9/11 happens and you realize
Battlestar Galactica.
And you realize the president's an idiot. And you also realize that the vice president is potentially dangerous. Wouldn't that be the liberal time to set up an extra government organization that's like, well, you guys just watch over the nukes, like, or you guys just watch over the, you know, super stealth bomber technology?
Well, it wouldn't be very liberal to create that without authorization or without transparency. This reminds me of a game that I just played over the holiday called Secret Hitler. Have you played Hitler?
I have not played Secret.
You know, it's a like a mafia type game with a little more structure to it. Where I highly recommend this game for large groups of people who want to scream and shout at each other while drinking. Highly, yeah. And basically, one person is Hitler, two people are their fascist accomplices, and everyone else is a liberal and trying to determine the identity of the fascists and Hitler. But in the game, if you accidentally enact fascist policies, you, even if you're a liberal, get to use fascist techniques to investigate your fellow players and suss and discover the identity of Hitler and the fascists. I think that's interesting because that's not what liberals would do. And what you're talking about right now is reminding me of it because you're basically undermining democracy to enact your liberal policy.
And that's not what liberals in theory would do. I'm just saying it sounds like what a government would do. And if it sounds like what a liberal government would do, like imagine all the times through history, a small group of white men is going to feel that exact same fear. You know, women get the vote. Minorities get the vote. The minorities start looking like they're going to outnumber the white people. The internet starts making it look like more voters might be able to like come out. Like all these sort of things, I could totally believe the most X-Files thing that I would have no problem believing is if you came out and you're like, hey, there's actually been a group of like 7 old white men who since like the 70s or the 50s or the 1870s have like successfully navigated, not they control the world. I'm not
We're more of an Illuminati
like
fan than not quite
like they
Illuminati, local Illuminati. Is there a word for that?
Yeah.
Localomity.
They have like a resource. They have a lock on something. They like own all the cable lines that, you know, the internet runs on or some like bullshit thing. They have
to make
like
money
weird...
or just to have a chip to bargain.
To have control. If there's a button that causes the end of the world, they want to have that possession of that button, you know.
I mean, you're convincing me that maybe there's something worth investing.
Maybe they're not putting stuff in the bee population to inoculate us against the alien virus.
I was
going to
bring up
I'm
the
sure
bees.
They're doing something.
I do think bees are suspicious.
Okay.
That's all I got.
Now's the time I listen to you. Bees are suspicious.
All of the speculative science fiction is about bees being bad. Black Mirror did some bee stuff. Bees are on our mind. Why are bees on our mind? I guess because they can
hive, they can
be programmed, they can sting.
They're like an important part of the ecosystem, so like if all the bees die, we're fucked.
They will.
So like maybe we should be worrying about controlling the bees.
Now here's the thing. The best foreign film went to Parasite.
Which, you know, works and it deservedly so.
Now that's about fighting against capitalistic society. But backfiring it. That's actually about liberals enacting fascist policies.
Okay.
Thoughts? No, actually, here's the real question for you. Is that the nicest house you've ever seen? And did it make you want that house? Is there some weird brain chemistry going on in Parasite where it's actually fetishizing wealth?
Maybe, but I still want the Roma house more. And I feel like I also spent more time in it.
Why do you like the Roma house more than the Parasite house? Because it has an outdoor area? It has poop on
I mean, the Parasite house has the... Oh, yeah. I mean, that's where you keep the dogs. You wouldn't have a dog. The Parasite one's like a little too sterile for me. And then like their upstairs is really separated from their downstairs. That's why, you know, they're able to like make out and hear people on the steps.
You want the open courtyard. Like, if someone's going to their room, you could watch them go all the way up to their room.
That's right. I like that sort of, like, open house. I don't have any secrets in the house. Well, I mean, if they are, they're behind a door. The open layout feels better to me.
Do you have a secret that you kept for a long time that came out?
Do I have a secret that I kept for a long time that came out? Not really. Do you?
I'm trying to think of the biggest secret that I ever kept from my family. I probably won't say it because they might be listening. But actually, mm-hmm. No, I didn't really keep any secrets from... Actually, someone gave me cigars in, like, 10th grade, and I was too scared to smoke them. And I locked them in a box in my room, and I was always worried that someone might find them. And I never wanted to use them. And I never did. I never smoked them. And that was a deep, dark secret. That was the heart beating under the floorboards in my room growing up. And I was like, how did you get these cigars? I don't even remember where they came from. But that was disturbing. And that weighed on me greatly. I don't like keeping secrets.
Yeah. I don't know if I had a secret like that. I mean, I definitely, like, hid stuff. But it wasn't, like, ashamed of it coming out. I lied one time that I felt bad about, which is that I was like dating girl A, and then girl A and I broke up, and then I started dating girl B, but girl A like wanted to like make out a little bit, so we made out, and then it ended up she was like using that against me, so she went to girl B and she's like, oh yeah, well Dave made out with me on April 22nd, and she had just gotten the day wrong because April 22nd was my brother's birthday. And so I was like, no, I was with my brother and my family all birthday. And girl A had her reputation for truth-telling tarnished, even though she was absolutely correct.
Damn.
Threw her right under that bus.
Now here's the question. Is that toxic male behavior, or is that fair behavior when you're in high school or middle school or wherever you were? You know what I mean? Like, in retrospect, some of these decisions that we make that are mean and unacceptable at the time seem kind of like, I was just teenage years, but they...
Well, I spent most of my life thinking, teenage years, so let me think about it the other way. Was I doing toxic male behavior? Yeah,
I mean, probably. Anyone cheating, that's not acceptable on any age.
Well, and then I got away with it because of luck, you know? If it, like, it eventually, everything had been aired, and, like, that's when, like, the weird conversation happened. Because there was going to be a conversation where one or all three of us were badly hurt. I just thought I was doing the correct thing and annexing it to one person. But that's just a way of thinking about it to not make it the fact that I was saving my own ass because she forgot a date. So did you ask me about toxic masculinity because we're going to talk about Joker?
No, I asked you about toxic masculinity because Renee Zellweger won for Judy. Now, what do you think of Judy?
I didn't see Judy. This feels like a very Golden Globe nomination and win to me, though. Did you see Judy?
I haven't seen Judy. I have a screener sitting on my desk, and I don't know. I can't bring myself to watch it. I don't know. I can't go for like the Oscar-y baitiest, stinkiest movie. It didn't get very good reviews. She's supposed to be very good in it. What do you think of Judy Garland? Do you have any connection? Judy Garland is a very important person to a lot of people on this planet. And I also do not have it much. Maybe I watched Wizard of Oz growing up. It was not a movie that I saw early on in my life.
I mean, coming across a lot of people in my lifetime that I think would self-describe themselves as theater gays, yeah, I have been adjacent to a lot of Judy Garland love, but it never was necessarily for me. And maybe that's partially it, and then also the thing that you said where it's like, it's a movie that got middling reviews, but she's supposed to be really good in it. Like, that's the kind of award season movie I'm like, maybe if it's coming up streaming sometime and I feel like it, but... I really don't feel like with the breadth of things to watch out there, I need to make time for something where it's like, well, this person's good in this shit. Like, I could pick this little nugget of gold out of this pile of dirt. I don't know if I need to make the time for that.
Yeah, I don't... watching trailers for Judy, it seems like it's about imitation. It's about melodrama. And I'm trying to think if there's ever been a great performance that's about imitation more than finding human emotion. Is there something that comes to mind for, like, who's doing the best impression? Is impression acting? Maybe that's my question to you, Dave.
I think sometimes it could be. I'm trying to think about what is acting? Good impression acting, though. I mean, there's something to be said. I mean, if you're talking about, like, Judy Garland, I think you kind of have to do a partial impression. Otherwise, it's going to read as weird. Or, like, a decision of the filmmaker to do, like, what if Judy Garland talked like this or walked like this?
Although that's, yeah. This is where, Tom Hanks in Won't You Be My Neighbor is the alternative to what you're describing. So, performing as someone who is so well known, has the, like, Pittsburgh-y accent, or Midwest accent, and, we've seen him on camera 1,000 times doing the exact same motions, the same lines, talking directly to camera. You have a connection with this person. They stare into your soul. You know Mr. Rogers, but, this is not, it's, Siri just started talking to me. My phone just started talking to me because I said Mr. Rogers. I don't know what activated that. Anyway, Mr. Rogers is so identifiable that there's no way even Tom Hanks, great performer, could do, an impression. So they do the opposite. He basically plays Tom Hanks dressed up as Mr. Rogers, which is more valuable. It's mining his charisma. It's mining our connection with him and finally seeing him talking to us on screen, and it feels really kind of eerie. It's totally different than I think anyone who would attempt to do a Mr. Rogers impression would be like doing those YouTube videos where someone is doing 50 impressions in 3 minutes or something. That's not acting.
Ooh,
impression.
What about
impressions
are
not
Joaquin acting. Phoenix in Walk the Line?
You think that's an impression?
That's sort of that's like a half impression sort of thing. I think he puts on the voice and the swagger. I mean, as much as Johnny Cash, non-performative reference material exists. It seems like he's pretty close.
Yeah, I mean, I still think that's. I don't think he tries to escape himself. I think the costuming brings him there, and maybe a slight affect. But I also don't think Johnny Cash is an easily imitatable person. Is that far-fetched? He has a deep voice.
No, that's a. Yeah.
Yeah. We were just talking about him doing his Nine Inch Nails cover.
Yeah, no, got the Cash on the mind. It's never a bad time to have the Cash on the mind, but also steering us back towards Joker. Let's talk about Joker. Why is this our best performance, and is it going to be our Oscar best performance?
Well, you're talking about toxic masculinity, and it was such an important conversation around the release of Joker. Not that the movie may even touch on that. I'm not sure does. I guess it inherently is about male behavior that hurts people, but it wasn't the movie that people feared, I don't think. But what is it? What Joker did we get? It was only in retrospect now can I start thinking about this movie outside of the discourse that we were immersed in and that people predicted it's going to spur violence. It's one thing and now it's another, and everyone is seeing it's like a Rorschach for people thinking about toxic male behavior, and yet I'm not sure what we got. I'm not sure what toxic male behavior is supposed to look like in this movie. What is this Joker? Is this Joker ready? Is this Joker relatable? Do you see anything real from real life in this Joker? Is there a line?
Do I see anything from real life in this Joker? I think it flirts with being a portrayal of mental illness and living with that from the inside. I think it really thinks it's doing that and would love to do that, but then is either incapable of it because of the source material or just decides it would rather be like more Batman. But things like Zazie Bates's character properly being killed off screen is weird, and it's a choice. And it's in the movie, and I don't know why. And at that point, you're sort of like in this momentum of the he's going to become the Joker that we know, and he's going to go on the show, and this is it. He's going to go visit tiny Bruce Wayne, because we know his quote-unquote secret at that point, that, you know, he's been wronged by women in his life, be they therapists or his mother, that he needs to become the choker. It just plays. There are things that you could make origin stories. You could make supervillain origin stories about mental illness for sure, but then saying, like, we're going to treat this seriously and then not, and then doing a comic book origin story left a bad taste in my mouth. The performance is probably good.
You don't feel sympathetic for him. You don't feel bad that he's been mistreated by the system, that he clearly has mental illness that's undiagnosed, that can't be treated, that he is... Is he an orphan? I can't remember.
No, his mom...
Abused
him.
Yeah.
And was... Right. He's mental illness.
I mean, so do you feel sympathetic to him?
I don't, but I'm aware that I'm being told that I should. Hmm. There's not a time that the movie's not kicking him in the face. And then it's sort of like the promise of the premise is he's going to become the person I know that is going to be the only person that, like, is the counterpoint to Batman, which in universe is your, like, most badass hero. It's not like a story that makes me feel bad about the circumstances he's in because of mental illness or because of child abuse or because of the economic crushing of the Waynes on all of Gotham. The movie touches on all of those things but doesn't address it. It's like a greatest hits of the hero's journey, but it's weird and perverse, which again sounds like a great pitch for a movie. If I sat down, it's like, I want to make a Joker movie, it's a perverse version of the hero's journey, great. But like this, it's sort of like a whole bunch of plot that orbits around Joaquin Phoenix, who's a little bit I think stuck because he doesn't have a specific mental illness. The Joker doesn't say I'm this. They give him his laughing thing, and Joaquin Phoenix invests as much as he does as an actor in that, trying to get the laugh right and trying to make the laugh iconic. But he's not playing a specific mental illness. He's playing an amalgamation of mental illness that's going to make a comic book supervillain. And so that's like my problem with the performance.
Yeah, I don't think the movie is successful at all, and that any conversations that we have about it are born from our own hope that there's depth that Todd Phillips has carved out here. I think it's totally mishandled. But I will say that I am thinking now, just talking with you, about like what's the tipping point of Joker, or what's the tipping point of people in this world that you lose sympathy for them, that they come, that they have had hardships and that they face an uphill climb in life, but you suddenly lose sympathy from them. I mean, heinous acts of violence are difficult to stomach, but what is that? It is like, does someone have to cross that dramatic of a line for you to lose sympathy for them? Or if they even do that, why do you lose sympathy for them if they've come from such a difficult place? And if he's suffering from mental illness, as it's kind of demonstrated here, like, do we feel bad that he's committed this act of violence? Or do you look down at him? I'm wondering, because if the conversation was about toxic masculinity, that seems like something that's born from intent, that you have become gnarled and warped in your own mind. And you've made a decision to be toxic, or to at least ignore the healing that you could potentially go for, like turn a cold shoulder to healing.
Maybe. I think it goes to go back to my story of lying about cheating. The narrative that I tell myself to make myself feel better is I, you know, avoided hurting all of us by, like, really hurting one person with a lie. And that's the narrative of toxic masculinity. It's not a choice. It's a point of view. So something like Joker, and I think all storytelling, unfortunately, you have to start with getting your audience to buy in with empathy. We should be at the point where, you know, you empathize with everybody. But that's, you know, a super intense way to live, and we don't. So when we escape to stories, you have to buy into empathy. The movie's going to tell you who the hero is or who you're supposed to be rooting for. And in Joker, we are rooting for Joker. Like, the guys who beat him up are assholes, and his boss is an asshole. And I think maybe the reason we don't see him kill Zazie Bates is because she is the closest thing to a character that does get equal empathetic treatment, but then it turns out it's all made up. It's part of that narrative to make somebody feel better rather than acknowledge what it really is. And I think all of the movies like this year, can you, if you look on like the empathy scale, the successful ones do build in empathy early on. Like even Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a hangout movie with two white guys realizing they're like losing power, which I said would create a syndicate at some point, but it doesn't. It creates like this melancholy and then like this sort of feeling that maybe you could change things, while simultaneously we know you can't change history. We see history changed, and it sort of works because you've made that empathy buy-in in the hangout portion of the movie. I don't think Joker had that empathy buy-in. And so, I don't know. I feel like there are other lead male performances this year that were much more successful at making me buy in my empathy. So Golden Globe, sure, because like you said, it doesn't matter. But if it becomes like Golden Globe and Oscar and a whole bunch of other awards, I'll go. Then it's Joaquin Phoenix's Joker. And it's like, he's a better actor than that. He's the master's Joaquin Phoenix.
Now here's a question. So talking about hilarious movies, best comedy went to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Uh-huh. Now,
do you think it's funnier? It's a hilarious movie. But do you think it's funnier that we all get worse at our jobs as time goes on, no matter what, and there's no stopping it, and we'll eventually be replaced? Or do you think it's funnier that there's no changing the past and we can only daydream about what we might have had if everything had gone right? Which part is funnier?
We're all going to get bad at our jobs. that one's funnier because that's the one that we always think like, no, I'm going to be the one that's different, where you make that generational mistake where it's like, no, I'm not, but no, you are. We're all going to get worse at our jobs. And
is there any avoiding getting worse at our jobs? Is there any, like, I think I'm already facing this quagmire about like, when do you get replaced, or when does time come for you at your occupation, and you have to constantly be reorganizing your life to figure out how to stay in the game? I mean, Once Upon a Time, I'm not an old man. I'm not as old as the people as Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but it strikes me as something like maybe more so. I don't know if it's a generational thing. I haven't talked to enough Gen Xers or boomers or people, other generations, about if they're plagued by this too. But at a certain point, you just wonder how you have to constantly be strategizing in this world to stay in the workforce. How do we do it?
Yeah, I think have a different job is the solution. I mean,
this is a particular problem to me. Is that what you're saying?
No. I'm saying that is the solution in our day and age. It's like you have to have a different job. You have to skip over to something else. Not completely different, like you have to retrain or something, although probably you still have one more retraining left in you, if we're being serious about the economy. But yeah, you have to do something else.
Get skills.
Yeah, because you're going to be eaten by the younger generation that is looking for their first thing, and their first thing is also going to expire like your thing's expiring. And, you know, we live for a long fucking time and we keep needing more money. So I think that's the solution.
How do you get skills in the year 2020? What are you read books or take classes, or what's the strategy?
Yeah, I think, I don't think you have to completely jump away from your core love of like criticism and telling stories. I think that's a wide breadth, but that doesn't mean that you couldn't suddenly become an immigration lawyer tomorrow if you wanted to. Well, I mean, you could start the 5-year process of going to school.
That would take a long time.
Yeah, but you could do it. You see, you're not that old, you know?
I'm speaking in the universal we here. Everyone will have to face this problem, right? That's not just yes, the media industry is, of course, imploding.
Well, I think...
please read Polygon.com, but...
I can't really name like an industry that it's feasible to have a job from like 18 until you retire. Like, how many times would you have to even switch, even if you were with one company the entire time, switch what your job was, you know? Like, people don't have decade-long times being an office manager or you know, vice president of Milwaukee washer and dryer.
Do you have any regrets about going to college?
Do I have any regrets about going to college? No, because I'm fortunate enough to have paid off my debt. And I met you guys there. It moved me to New York. I got my job there by... It really just moved me there and introduced me to people. I don't think I paid for an education I couldn't have gotten by meeting smart people and reading good books. But I don't regret it because it got me where I was. If I was, you know, like you eventually have to tell your child that she's going to go to
college. That's what I'm thinking about right now. I'm like... How do you gain all the skills? How do you gain the most skills that are usable in the future? If I'm instructing a child, do they go to college? Do they just try and amass all sorts of different handy skills? Like, I don't know what the world's going to be like in 20 years. I don't know how the job force changes. I don't know. I'm trying to reflect on my own, like, liberal arts experience, too. I got a BFA. I mean, could it be more useless? I guess. I'm glad I got into this work, and I'm glad we get to talk about this, and I'm glad we met all each other. But, you know, how do you approach college and learning, and what is the foundation? What's, like, the most important thing that you can study hard about if you're a young person now?
I would say, I don't know, focus. Well, basically that's what college is for everybody. Is you're suddenly outside of this like K through 12 system where there are a lot of benchmarks that everybody needs to meet, and everybody's meeting them and everybody's dealing with them and blah blah blah. It's very super relatable. You're probably living with your parents for the majority of that time, unless you're an emancipated minor of some sort. And then college is like that time period, whether or not you actually attend like a university or whatnot, where you have to figure out how to like budget your own time and meet people in your own way. So I would say, like, if you could get interested in something, like you, the audience, and you, Matt Patches, I guess, but like you read something and you're like, oh, I didn't know about that part of history, or you watch something and you're like, I wonder if there are more movies like in this series, or what has this director done? Or, you know, you have a really good meal at a restaurant and you're like, I wonder how they made that. If you're able to channel that focus into like, going out and exploring the world of knowledge, I think that's the successful thing that college teaches you.
I think that's a great point. And in my own, we're changing decades. What am I doing in the next 10 years of my life? Self-reflection moment, which I don't often do. I'm not a resolutions person. I'm not like a take a step back and size up the year to come person. But I have been thinking about like what do I need to change my life to actually make life better for me, and focus is a big part of that. I think we've all become addicted. We all have an addiction. It's being online, it's being on a screen. I don't think screen time and futzing on your phone is inherently bad, but I do think phones and social media specifically is an addiction, like cigarettes. No offense, Dave, you smoke, you're addicted to cigarettes.
Hey, I'm on Juuls now.
You're gonna die from Juul. Or alcohol, or like it is just as bad as all. It is a true addiction, and I'm trying to approach in this next year, in this next 10 years, this social media emergence as a true addiction. Trying to kick it, which is almost impossible because of what we do for a living. We're plugged in, but like, and regain focus. And I hope that the next generation, or if I'm telling people what to study now, I think actually focus and regaining attention and like sitting down and watching The Whole Irishman without looking at your phone is one of the most important things that you could possibly do in the next year. Or I really, really want to take it seriously as kicking an addiction. And I hope you'll support me, Dave, because I deleted Twitter and all that shit from my phone. and I'll use it for work sometimes, but I'm taking precautions and I'm really trying to get serious about it because I do think focus and like, what does that mean for my kid in the future? It means reading books. It means going outside. It means making, hopefully I can fall on my sword and look like a really bad example for my kid. I don't want my kid, like eventually the kid will get a phone, right? Like eventually the kid will plug in, but you want to look like such a disgrace that they will not want to use their phone. That's the hope, that I can appear to be on my phone so much that they won't want to do it. And they'll actually live life and really focus on learning different things. It's no longer about just like the topics to learn. It's about how you learn and how you process the world in order to stay relevant. Because I think having answers to questions or having an interest in knowledge is going to become the most powerful thing that could possibly happen in the future.
Yeah. I would also say be wary of the phone. It's a tool. And so the more you could teach it to be used as a tool, the more like, cause the reality is we have a supercomputer in our pocket at all times. Like imagine.
It's like Tron.
Like the mind. Yeah. Well, imagine the minds of like the world past, what they would have like wanted to do with the knowledge. And then maybe try like doing that with the knowledge. I don't know. It's interesting.
I'm doing more crossword puzzles in 2020. That is my resolution. Well, you did the super gigantic New York Times crossword puzzle over New Year's. Very fulfilling experience. Everyone should get some sort of crossword puzzle app. It is my new Twitter. And that is my big suggestion for people. Here's how we wrap up the segment, Dave.
Yes.
Best drama of the year, according to the Golden Globes, was 1917, a movie that no one thought was going to win. No one was talking about it. I do want to say that in our private chat room that you and I have on a daily basis, a few weeks ago, I said that 1917 was going to win Best Picture at the Oscars. I regret not tweeting it. Now, that makes no sense based on what I just was ranting about, but I just want you to confirm, didn't I say this, so that people yes. know that I could brag, but I don't have tweeted or written evidence that I made this claim.
I have not seen 1917 yet.
We'll talk about it on the podcast later.
I do know that it was like, I got to make sure to, you know, see it in theaters because apparently it's good enough that Patches thinks it's going to win Best Picture.
Well, that's not why. I mean, I don't want to get too more deep in it because we'll talk about it later. But quality is not the reason 1917 is going to win Best Picture.
This is the thing about... I love having people as friends who could do this dissection for me because I just need someone to tell me what the good movies are. That's where my schedule is for 2020.
That's important.
Tell me what the good movies are.
No, but here's the real question on 1917. Sam Mendes has been talking a lot about his grandfather going to war, bring back these stories. His grandfather was he didn't know what his war experience was like. Because he was a kid. He wasn't going to go up to his grandpa and be like, what was it like being in World War I? But he would see his grandfather wash his hands. He would constantly be washing his hands before ever doing anything. And finally, he asked his dad, like, why is he washing his hands? And it's because he's, like, washing the war away every time. And I don't know if that's true or not. It sounds very mythic when Sam Mendes says it in his soft British accent and he's hyping his movie in front of an audience at the Directors Guild Theater in New York City. Hype, 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 whatever. But there's this very like mythic quality to war. And 1917 is a very movie war movie. I mean, it's tropey and it's a throwback to generations of war filmmaking. And then, but like, there's like war in the air. And all this war is like, war. Bad. War. There's never a good reason to go to war. Right, Dave?
Right. Yeah, that's definitely how I should end this segment. Let's not go to war, for sure. I also... I don't think it's bad to see the war treated cinematically. Unfortunately, because we have that war as far enough back, there is, like you said, like a cinematic history to images captured from it, or American cinema trying to capture images from it, British cinema as well. Yeah, war is bad.
War is bad.
Who knew that, I could have told you that between a real war and a Star War, the Star War was better.
The Star War is easy. It goes down easier. Okay, although I will say this.
The dead speak.
1917 has the horrors of war. Do you think that at any point Star Wars captured the horror of war? I mean, maybe the opening of The Last Jedi was terrifying. Someone self-sacrificed. But oddly enough, The Rise of Skywalker... Actually, The Rise of Skywalker... Here's how we end this podcast. Well,
okay.
What was the grimmest moment in all of Star Wars history? For me, I think it's The Rise of Skywalker. In the end, when we've learned that Finn... being a former stormtrooper who escaped and has learned that most stormtroopers are orphans who were snatched up kids, put in stormtrooper outfits and sent to battle. Finn proceeds to obliterate them. no mercy, just destroying stormtroopers left and right, gunning them down. Poe is screaming at him to kill all these people. And you just sit there thinking like, these are good people. They didn't do anything wrong. That's dark.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for having a podcast.
it's as dark as, you know, the Alderaanian genocide being a big flashy moment, for three people on a Death Star and, Tron Legacy's complete genocide of a whole programmed race in a monologue.
Whoa, Tron Legacy.
Tron Legacy definitely has an off-screen genocide because I make fun of that all the time. They're like, this Tron Legacy was so uninteresting, it cut the genocide.
There's a lot of grim, dark shit out there right now. And I hope that everyone finds some light and some optimism. I wouldn't watch the Golden Globes to find that, but it's too late. You probably already did, and that sucks for you. But maybe the Oscars will be sweet. I don't know. Dave, is there something pure out there in the world that we'll find that's good?
Let's see. Let's bring it all together. Movies are empathy machines, and learning to watch them better by watching a lot of them will help you bring empathy into your real life, and that's what will end war.
I just want to say that I don't think our podcast is like any other podcast on the planet. Thanks, Dave.
that is true.
We're a movie podcast.
This has been Fighting in the War Room, Year 9 special. We will see you next week with Katie and a numerical episode with segments and subjects. Till then, Patches, where can people find your work online?
Polygon.com.
Oh, yeah. And you can find me at DA7E. And we are back to the island for the Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. We're doing the other 48 days in season 2 this week, which means back to the island, back to the past.
What was that foot statue?
Comfortable past. Can't tell you, Patches. That's a spoiler.
Damn.
All right. We'll see you guys next week.
Bum-ba-dum, the tum-pum-dum, a pum-pum-dum, the gung-gung-dum, ba-bum-ba-bum-ba-bum, now I'm done, we're done.